the speaker for this evening. The speaker is Dr. Mozella Mitchell. At the present time, Dr. Mitchell is not a member of this society. Dr. Mitchell is a PhD graduate from Emory University, and there are some of us who have known her over the years in various ways. I think the other Mitchells here probably know her better than probably any of us, because they knew a long time ago when she was up there at Colgate Rochester. Although they tell me that they're not related by blood, they are related maybe deeper than blood. So it's just well that she's here. I mean, she should have been here a long time ago, although she said this afternoon, well, this was just the right time for her to be here. But I'm happy to think that I thought about her being here, even though she's got all this other thing going for her. I thought she ought to be here. Incidentally, she will be placed in nomination for membership following the dictates of our last meeting and the and the resolution made at that meeting. Dr. Mitchell has spent a great deal of her time intellectually working on the life and thought of Howard Thurman, and she's written quite a few things on Howard Thurman. The title that I have here is it may not be exactly what she's going to do, but it's going to be about Howard Thurman. I took this title from one of the one of the articles she had written on Howard Thurman, because it sounded so rich. I will read that title because I like the sound of it. It's called The Shaman's Doorway: Techniques of Myth and Ritual in the Thought of Howard Thurman. Without further ado, I will introduce Dr. Mitchell, who will give her presentation, after which Dr. Evans Crawford will respond, and if there's anything left, I might say a word or two. And we'll have a few questions. Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you very much for that inspiring introduction. And in regard to the Mitchells, one thing, we are related because Dr. Mitchell and I have the same name. They used to get us confused. Her name is Ella and mine is Mozella. So they didn't know which one we were many times. So I'm honored to be invited to speak before this society and to be nominated for membership in this society. It's a great honor for me, and I'm here with some of my former professors, and this is, I feel real good tonight on this. The paper that I'm going to speak from has already been published in two occasions. This is published in the 1982 special edition of Debate and Understanding, and it's also published in the book on Howard Thurman, Chapter 2, in this book, which came out in July. So I'm going to simply summarize some of the aspects of it and do a kind of a summary commentation on it, so it will be very short, and then we will proceed from there. Thurman is somewhat similar to the Bodhisattva in the Mahayana Buddhism variety, who, having achieved enlightenment themselves, postpone their final salvation, nirvana, until all human beings have achieved enlightenment. So they are a very humanitarian type of religious figure. The article which I wrote dealing with the techniques of myth and ritual in Thurman is an attempt to address the method of Thurman, to assess the style and character of Thurman from the practical religious standpoint. That is, as Thurman moved from the inner religious ruminations to become an instrument in the process of spiritual whole making in other individuals and in the external community and in general. The ideal of unity with God and with all of life is the goal that he would achieve, the goal that this such a healing would achieve, or the goal that would achieve such a healing. As you so well know, Thurman was not a public person. He was not one to draw mass crowds. He was not a movement man who would gain wide appeal like King or Jackson or Malcolm X or others. But he was a private person who was engaged in a successful inner spiritual journey and found unique ways of sharing the insights and experience of that journey with others. Because of the techniques of myth and ritual he uses, I refer to him as a modern-day sophisticated shaman, not because he considered himself a shaman, not because he deliberately chose to use shamanic practices and techniques, but rather because, as one who was familiar and fascinated with multicultural religious traditions and practices, he naturally, perhaps unconsciously, maybe consciously at times, he would draw upon the best that his experiences could provide him with to achieve the spiritual, social goals of his own mission, which he said was to address the hunger of the human heart, as was suggested to him by George Cross at Colgate Rochester Divinity School. He turned from orthodox practices which he saw as failing to achieve this goal, and he turned to first-hand phenomenological experience of religion. Back behind the systems, belief systems and doctrines, to, so far as possible, to the personal encounter with the numinous. At the very core of the human inner self, when everything else is stripped away, one finds the basis for union both with God and with all of life. The first such encounter with the numinous came upon his initial conversion experience as a small boy around 12. After a while, he cultivated a habit of mystic engagement whereby he would periodically renew his conversion rebirth experiences using such spiritual disciplines of as prayer and meditation, so forth. And each time he would go through these conversion experiences, he would go through on a higher and higher spiritual enlightenment. He would achieve a higher and higher spiritual enlightenment going through these repeated conversion experiences. And he would achieve a greater self-surrender and commitment to God, a spiritual commitment. He cultivated the shaman type of ability to participate in the sacred more completely and more fully than other persons, and to communicate that experience to others, or even to lead others into such a participation. His shamanic ecstasies were shared before large and small audiences whose members were never the same after they had heard him. These experiences were also conveyed in his writings, especially the poems and meditations. It is commonly believed that numinous and ecstatic experiences are ineffable, but with his poetic style and literary imagination, Thurman came closest to perfection in conveying these experiences, both orally and in writing. I find this tendency best demonstrated in his writings in 7 of his 22 books, written between 1951 and 1971, containing meditations, poetry, prayers, theological and philosophical expositions. The works, these 7 works, emerge from the spiritual journey in which the author was engaged, which involved inner spiritual explorations and outward, or followed by outward manifestations of these revealed truths that had come to him in these inner explorations. It is a quest for spiritual enlightenment, for God, quest for God. Much is learned, as is presented in each one of these books, and each book presents a higher and higher level of understanding. The first book, Deep is the Hunger, initiates the search, which is echoed in the very title, Deep is the Hunger. It is the result of an intensified probing of the inner landscape. The mind broods on history, culture, religion, the church, the social order, examining these from the inner region of truth. In the inner world, one meets God and then judges and determines the outer world from that standpoint. The second book, Meditations of the Heart, came 2 years later, is indicative of a heightening of the quest. The self here is desirous of more surrender and the permission of God to pervade the self more fully. And he quotes Psalm 19:14, for instance, let the words of my mouth, the meditations of my heart, and so forth. The image of the island on the inward sea with an altar guarded by an angel with the flaming sword dominates this book. The third book, The Creative Encounter, is a discursive one in which the author shares the intellectual and theological insights gained from the inward journeying. Conversion, transformation has taken place. New insights for religion have been gained. The creative encounter is the encounter between the human person and God. And upon this encounter, he comments, in the presence of God, there is neither male nor female, white nor black, Gentile nor Greek, Protestant nor Catholic, Hindu, Buddhist, nor Muslim, but a human spirit stripped to the literal substance of itself before God. In the fourth book, the insights gained explodes in sermonic writings which expand to the point of processed thought, as implied by the title of the book, The Growing Edge. Everything is in a state of flux, moving toward perfection and union with God. The fifth book is evident of a return to the sacred realm, the inwardness of the search for wholeness, as the title suggests, The Inward Journey, and this was his favorite book. It is clearly on a higher and broader scale than the search has taken otherwise in the earlier books. It is a quest for understanding, a quest for fulfillment, for love, for peace, for God. These are the titles of the various divisions of the book. The mythic dimensions are more evident here as the author enters the mythic mode by way of the experiences of Jesus, David, Paul, and he enters these experiences of these forebears by reintuiting their experiences through certain key scriptures such as Psalm 139 and 1 Corinthians the 13th chapter, and the gospel portions, especially where Jesus underwent his temptations and his cross experience, and others. The sixth book, Disciplines of the Spirit, is another discursive book in which Thurman fits his knowledge of the creative spiritual life into a kind of structure, a kind of scheme or system. This book resulted from the course that he taught at Boston University titled Disciplines of the Spirit. And this system falls into categories of suffering, prayer, commitment, growing in wisdom and stature, and reconciliation. It is a mature statement, a mature theological statement of Christian experience, of the Christian experience of conversion and growth to spiritual maturity. The seventh book in the series, The Search for Common Ground, put the whole journey of life into a perspective of processed thought. Here we see that he has not simply been engaged in his own spiritual journey, but the journey of all of life. He has served as an agent in the grip of a divine moving that has been going on, and he has been assisting in a healing process going on in the whole universe. He says, "My body participates completely in the life process, and it is nourished and sustained by ancient processes as old as life and set in motion before any awareness or knowledge about them was in evidence." That's most of what was in the written presentations. Now, in the oral presentations, Thurman's style has legendary status and achieved legendary status long before his death. But my thesis concerning these shamanistic qualities in him is best seen in the oral presentations. And Elizabeth Yates helped me to see this in her vivid descriptions of his speech occasions, the way he held his audiences enwrapped and took them on spiritual healing journeys while yet in their seats, and how he emerged, remark how the audience, people in the audience emerged remarkably and profoundly changed. And this is all that I'm going to say concerning the book and the article.
Thank you very much. You see that Dr. Mitchell is not yet a member of the society because we tend to be much more long-winded. And it's the question of whether she is setting an example, whether she will learn to be as we. In any case, I will ask now Evans Crawford to come and make his commentary.
Thank you, Mr. President, and I want to express my appreciation to Dr. Mitchell for the paper. When Chuck called me up and asked me to share in it, I didn't think he was calling me because I succeeded Dr. Thurman here. But when I've gotten the paper, I searched for it, and I want to say I respond to it, convinced Dr. Mitchell that God in this presentation has kind of pronounced judgment upon me. Shelby is not here. I remember once that Wesley, when he was supposed to comment on the paper that I wrote, I didn't have a term for it then, but I guess I was more mystic than I realized, and I took my mysticism right on up until the presentation. And he did not have benefit of my mysticism. So I figure that in some extent God is punishing me here tonight, not because of your failure, but because the paper that was mailed to me by Chuck got into Howard's campus mail. And it was even more mystical. But what you must understand, it's not much different with the U.S. mail now either. But certainly this paper, and I do have the whole paper and some of the other publications, certainly deserves much more time and study. And I came to it by the title of reading it, very excited, and I showed it to several of my colleagues in the university who requested permission to be here, and I had to give them the word that you do have some rules on this. And I was also convinced that you were using, as I saw it, some of the concepts from what I understand the history of religion field, which I admire, but which I'm very leery about my competence, at least as compared to others in this society, especially our chairman. But I have dived off the diving board before in the deep water, so here I go again. Actually, what I will do is comment on that part of Dr. Mitchell's paper which resonates in the field that I have associated with my social ethics position here, which has been the field of preaching. I guess if now I would have given my title, I would say I'm in social ethics and preaching here. First, let me say that the consideration of Thurman's thought and preaching in terms of the mythic structure is liberating for those of us who have long appreciated him and felt that the usual categories of analyst and analysis and evaluation that we usually bring to it from the rhetoric have been inadequate to catch this man's head and heart, to use his own words. And as a shaman, however, it took some conditioning for me, given what I know of him in several university settings. I have had personal encounters with him both at Marsh Chapel in Boston and at Rankin Chapel at Howard, mostly when he came back to visit and to lecture. And certainly in the university with its rational setting, it seemed an odd place to think of Thurman as a shaman. In fact, I remember when he first came to Boston, and his style, his pace, this upset the place because it just didn't fit in with the things that we had there. And Dr. Thurman was over at Marsh at the same time that Buttrick was over for a portion of the time over at Harvard, and some of the staff would say that they could just take Dr. Thurman so long, and then they'd have to go over and get Buttrick. I guess it was the difference between what they saw as clarity. But as I've come to the society, and as I thought about your paper, I think that basically this concept certainly helps me appreciate and have a some categories into which to now openly affirm what must be called his opaque style. I call it that because certainly Dr. Thurman, as I have responded to him and as others have, I was surprised to hear the wife of one of my wife, I mean the husband, one of my wife's colleagues who were going to a music conference once, and when he said he was up in Boston, he used to go regularly to hear Dr. Thurman. He was not a clergy. But he said he always liked Dr. Thurman because he always left him with something to work on. And the thing I'm appreciating here with your paper is that as I have taught preaching and as I have used the rhetorical categories to try to catch his style, he escapes it. And I think this certainly seems to be an approach that will let us treat him in the scholarly way that he deserves and as a great thinker and as a great communicator. Now, the great communicator category has been polluted in this city. I will not call names because it's dangerous. But certainly in the sense in which you meant it, Dr. Mitchell. So I particularly appreciate this. It also helps me deal with something that Dr. Thurman and I talked about the last visit he made here, but which you have known, and I'm certain Smith has known in writing, but he always said you couldn't teach preaching. And I said to him, Dr. Thurman, you're messing with my livelihood when you say that. And at one particular time in our class, we had one student, a very brilliant student, now pastoring in this area. She raised questions in such a way that we kind of took that as a theme that resonated throughout our semester. What did it mean that you couldn't teach preaching? And I think in the process of working here in the consortium with input from Protestant Theological Seminary and the Roman Catholic Seminary, just to mention two great traditions, along with Methodists and others, we wrestled with it because we know in the Catholic tradition, and to some extent, I presume, in the Episcopal tradition, they think about preaching as a part of spiritual formation. Dean Jones and I have had some trouble with the phrasing of it, or at least the history of it as we have thought about it. But we think that Dr. Thurman, with this statement, and I have asked him, I've talked to him about it as we've written to and from the airports here and other places, we seem to think that he was really embodying that without using that word. He was trying to make a place for the spiritual dimension in preaching. I would not use the word spiritual formation, but spirituality in preaching. And the reason I appreciate the paper is because it has given me some categories and related it to an important field. I would say I'm interested in going into some insights, not that you got them from there, and the history of religions, to give the substance to what we were doing. We sort of felt it. We wanted to make a place for spirituality in preaching. And certainly Dr. Thurman embodies that, and by pointing to his ability to write and to use imagination and to reach the poetic style, if I spoke about opaque style, really the poetic style, then it seems to me that we have a category in which to explore that further. I'm particularly grateful for your use of the categories with respect to his oral style. Because there was always something in Dr. Thurman there that you especially could not catch with the categories. I have a sheet that I used partially from Clellan at Duke, who developed some categories for evaluating a sermon, but also I've increased it in other years from categories I've gotten from Henry Mitchell and others. But Howard Thurman is a sort of a behavioral preacher. I mean, you have to find his gestures and his pauses are interesting. This is the first time I've been able to think of a way that I could grasp his pause. He is noted for that. As a matter of fact, a personal thing that came to mind as I read that particular section of your paper which you just touched on here tonight, and it would be good if all of you could read her analysis with respect to his oral style. When I first heard him along with my wife in Boston University, the first time I heard him, he said, "Let us pray." Now, you all know what I'm going to say. And we bowed our heads, and we waited, and we waited, and we waited and waited. And so when nothing happened, given my own pace as a person changed, I peaked. And then he began to pray. And then on the way, we were commuted down from Providence. And on the way, my wife said to me as we drove back, she said, "You know, that was the most meaningful experience of prayer I've ever had." And I realized that perhaps I was too professional to get it. But I think beyond my own personal thing, and that's out of place here, I think that you recognize that this was the kind of peak experience that a number of people had with Dr. Thurman. Now, of course, naturally, publish or perish, you put it in books, but you couldn't put it all in books. And it seems to me that this approach to him, to look at it in terms perhaps of ritual, for as James Massey said in the his analysis of the preaching of Thurman, that for Thurman, preaching was a form of worship. That resonated with me because one of the things that is my annual sermon here for new entrants and students and for the whole community, really, is that word that the rabbi said to me a few years ago when he pushed across to me a paper that he was doing, and I was in the General Library in Boston. He said, "Would you look at that and evaluate it?" And I looked at it, and he said, "Let me give you some background." He said, "I'm going to give that to a Hebrew school, it's graduating class." He said, "In our tradition, you know, study is a form of worship." And I thought about it. I had never thought about it that way before. So one reason I was in the library is because I hadn't worshiped very well. I was cramming for an examination. But I thought that the worship is a form of worship. And then I recalled also with these concepts how at Boston, along with some of the students, we would go over to Dr. Thurman on Bay State Road and try to find out, what was his style of preaching. We were reading all of the books on preaching and patterns and so forth. And of course, you know, he has said in some places that what he does, or what he did, was to put the concept to bed. I'm saying that your categories now shows us that it became a part of his theology. It was a part of growing, sharing with the people. And indeed, he was the shaman illuminates it. I just it's just hard for me to know someone and with the idea that I've had of that. I thought at first it was going to feed into the pietistic dimensions, but that has been, as you have pointed out, Smith, one of the reasons that some people have felt that they've differed with Thurman, because it seems to be too pietistic and has happened a rather disastrous affinity with the worst of fundamentalism. But those of us who know Thurman, and this is the last thing I want to say, that your concept of healing was informative to me, because Dr. Thurman, preaching to, really, the black intellectual, but not only the black intellectual, was able, and from their own testimony that I have here, I just had a person recently on the night in which we had our formal opening recently, when the Black Caucus met here and Mayor Bradley spoke, we met after Dr. Cheek. And some of the people who had come back said, "Well, you're the dean of the chapel," and said, "You know, I used to love to listen to him. Never understood a thing he said, but somehow I just felt good to be there." Well, none of these people I would call black intellectuals, but I never thought before of it in terms of healing, but the special agony that all people feel, but particularly in the university, and particularly those special pains that those of us who are victimized feel, Dr. Thurman was able to do it. And he did it all the way from Oberlin throughout his entire ministry without succumbing to the things that tempts all of my students with the orthodoxies and the hooping and the other things. So I find this paper, by looking at the mythic and ritual captures something that I have felt in Thurman. Secondly, it captures something that my students who have dealt with students, and particularly brings his gestures, which themselves he can just make a point and stop and shake his fingers, and you had no way to catch it. And it will allow me to give some content now to a class that I've been teaching for a number of years. It has some people tell me it has a nice ring, but I've been in doubt if I had much confidence. I call it preaching as a folk and a fine art, because it was an effort to capture some of these things, and I find your paper one that I would like to require my students to read, and I would like to further dialogue with you in terms of some of the concepts as to the history of religion brings to an analysis of after the capture the essence of a human being. Thank you very much.
Since Henry Young couldn't be here, I thought I'd just fill in. I try to stay off of these programs because, you know, I have enough to do. And generally when I talk, I say too much. But I'd like to say a word or two about, generally about Howard Thurman and some of the aspects of this life that were brought out in this paper. One of the things that that occurred with the advent of black theology was a certain kind of absence. And that absence was noted in the sense that it took some time for those people engaged in black theology to come to terms or to even acknowledge or say a word or two one way or another about Howard Thurman. The question is, well, why? Why didn't people immediately say, well, now let's look back here and see what Howard Thurman said about this, that, the other thing? But nobody did. It's only now that those people who are of that generation of black theology are beginning to look at Thurman. We have two of those folks sitting here. There's a student at Duke now who is working on a dissertation on Howard Thurman. There's a young man who has been a lover of Howard Thurman up in Detroit for years, but he hadn't written anything. He just goes around loving him. But so we have to ask, well, why is this? Well, I think part of the reason for it is are certain kinds of mistakes that black people have about themselves. First of all, I think one of those mistakes is that black people, as a group of people, as a cultural force, as a cultural form, always think of themselves much too often as people who can deal with their lives always in terms of some kind of resolution of continuity. And by that I mean that they always think that there is a continuous, almost causal way by which they can understand life and also resolve the tensions of their lives. A great deal of this has to do, for example, with black people thinking that if they can get their roots in Africa, everything's going to be all right. Black people thinking that if they can just find out whatever the slave tradition was in this country and push that, then everything's going to be all right. Or if they pass another civil rights bill, everything's going to be all right. Black people are always looking for resolutions of continuity. Now, I'm not saying that one shouldn't do that. I'm just saying that it minimizes one's perspective on life to think that one is a human being only in terms of geographical and historical contiguities. One of the things that Howard Thurman did was to insist upon the fact that no person or no people, and especially black people, were simply what they were on the basis of geographical and historical contiguities. He furthermore insisted upon the fact, which was brought out by Mosella, that black people have an inner life. See, often black people forget themselves that they have an inner life. Having been dominated so much by a peculiarity of their color, which is a public gaze, and also having been looked upon so often as if the full meaning of their life was a part of a political kind of movement of some sort or another, they themselves have forgotten that they had an inner life. And to the extent that they had an inner life, they allowed other people to define what it was. That we have very little in the black tradition, at least as it relates to the study of that tradition among scholars, that alludes at any point to the inner life of black folk. And to the extent that it is done, it is a minor thing. Black people are people who always see themselves as movement people, public people, people who are always out there in full view, as if there is no inner structure to the meaning of their existence at all. Howard Thurman said, that's not right. As a matter of fact, that's a lie. And one of the reasons he didn't fit, and one of the reasons that nobody thought about him immediately when we all got involved with this black theology, is because he didn't fit. Shamans never fit. The very definition of a shaman is a person who doesn't fit in his own or her own society. A shaman is a queer person. A shaman is a person who stands out within the society that they are part of as being rather odd. One of the noti of a shaman is that they are odd. And what does the shaman do? I like this thing that Mozella said that, well, she said two or three things there right at the beginning. She said he was like a bodhisattva, and she said he was a shaman. So let's play with that a little bit. Now, what is the bodhisattva? The bodhisattva is that kind of being who was like the Buddha. The Buddha, having attained enlightenment, he was there, wherever that there was, he was there. But then, instead of just saying, well, I'm going to be here, and that's all right. If anybody else makes it, okay. But that's not my problem. Just at the moment when the Buddha could have done that, the Buddha said, no, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going back to save all sentient beings. And what is the shaman? The shaman is that person, that odd person in the community, who, because of their peculiar kinds of abilities, their modes of knowing how to get to the inner life and the other world, through spiritual techniques, sets out upon a journey to the inner and other world for the sake of the salvation of the community. The shaman undertakes this journey. The shaman undergoes this journey to confront all of the demonic forms, all of that which is fearful, destructive, and frightening in the other world and the inner life. The shaman, in this sense, sets out upon a conquest of the inner life for the salvation of the community. And the shaman sets out upon this inner life to bring salvation to the community that the shaman is a part of. The shaman is a therapeutic being. The shaman, through ecstatic technique, and Howard Thurman's ecstatic technique was his preaching. When Howard preached, he was in ecstasy. And it was through that ecstasy that he made you know the inner life. And the reason that what he was talking about was opaque, or what he was communicating seemed opaque, or the reason people could say, well, I love to hear him preach, but I don't know what he said. Or the reason he could say, let us pray, and then keep you waiting, look like an hour or so. And then somebody said, well, you know, that was meaningful. is because he was taking you into this ecstasy. And he was letting you know you can go there now because I've been there. Because the shaman also carries a sword. The shaman carries a sword and the shaman carries a drum. And the drum is there to beat a new rhythm. To give you a new sense of the rhythm of life itself such that you can get back on track. The shaman has to beat a drum. The beating of the drum is part of the technique of the shaman. And Howard's drum was his mouth. And the rhythm of his language and the style of his gesture, that was his drum and that was his sword. The other thing about Howard but strangely enough, I think in many respects he was more modern and more radical than the black theologians. Now, why do I say that? Why do I say that? Well, one reason I say it is just to be controversial. But the other reason I'm saying it is because Howard realized that black people living in America were probably the most intensely modern people in the world. Now that's a strange notion because you always think of if somebody is really modern, they're the people who are walking down on Wall Street and having all the right style. No, he says that no, you are the most modern people in the world. You are people so modern that when you start thinking about the tradition that you are part of, your traditions are so fragmented, so messed up, having no conscious line, having no self-conscious development. No matter what you do about Africa and where you came from and Queen of Sheba and Ethiopia and all that, it really doesn't wash when it comes down to a community unconsciously knowing who they are and where they came from. Howard was saying, therefore, your only option is the human tradition. Your only option is the human tradition. And that option you must grasp and take almost with desperation. Therefore, his playing around with Hinduism, his playing around with Buddhism, his playing around with all these religions was not some kind of little thing that we've been seeing going on since the 60s, where everybody thought, we just have a little wisdom of the East and we're going to be all right. No, this was a desperate intensity in the man. A desperate intensity because he felt that all life was a unity. All life was a unity. And it wasn't a unity simply in terms of some idealistic speculative notion. It was a unity if you examine all of life in terms of its totality. And this is where he comes back to the fact that black people didn't understand they had an inner life. They only thought they were public people made by somebody else's gains. But once you began to understand the inner life, then you began to understand that the rhythms of that inner life, the modes of that inner life, were not simply limited to your tradition or this or that. You might find the rhythms of that life anywhere. So Howard was modern in that sense. He was not just a kind of student who wanted to know the other religions as a scholar. He wanted to know those other religions to figure out the contours of the human soul. And therefore, he was the black man who opens up to us the world of others, the world outside of our own traditions, not in the form of normative imperialistic structures, but as orders of the human soul, as resources for the human spirit. At our last meeting, Cain Feller was reading a paper, and he made a statement about what he called subversive knowledges. And he attributed that phrase to Foucault. And he writes, Foucault said it first, subversive knowledges. Now, what are these subversive knowledges? These subversive knowledges are precisely those kinds of modes of thought and modes of expression with which Howard was experimenting, moving, acting, behaving, and thinking always a bit off of center of common discourse and behavior, reminding one always of the more than. And that more than for Howard was always the simple and modest notion that you are only human, and that's all. That was the more than. And it was a realization Howard had that many or most of our human problems are failures to come to terms with that modesty. And a failure to come to terms with that modesty created the abuses we heaped upon others and upon ourselves. Those of you who know, who knew Howard very well, you know, he didn't fly an airplane. He had to go somewhere. He'd get him a train or bus or something. And he couldn't get there on time. It's all right. And he would tell you in a minute. I remember the last statement he told me. He said, "Let me tell you something, boy. I take care of my body." And by that, he didn't mean any little thing like, "I don't smoke it, I don't drink it, I don't have it." He meant this was what he had. That's all he had. The body was his life. And that was the way he was connected with things. And therefore, he took care of his connection. Very powerful man. And I'm glad that Mozilla came here to give us this talk about Howard Thurman. Because as I see it, Howard Thurman, within the arenas of our deliberations as colleagues and scholars, will remain for some time a spirit, a thought, and a person with which we must conjure for some time. Okay. Thank you. Mozilla, you can say what you want to say. But maybe you want to make a response and you have 2 seconds.
Well, I'm simply overwhelmed by the response to my paper. This writing has been taking place over a number of years, and I have never had other than my dissertation committee, of which Dr. Smith was one of the members, and two others members. I had never had any feedback on the material that I had written on Thurman, the work that I had been doing, except when the article did come out in Debate and Understanding. At various conferences, I did meet one or two people who did speak to me about it, but as far as any extended response to the work on Thurman, I hadn't had this kind, so forgive me if I am sort of overwhelmed and speechless about the positive response that I have received tonight. I must say that I met Thurman first through legend when I was teaching in Memphis, Tennessee in 1962 or 1963. I heard some ministers, I was teaching at junior college in Memphis, I heard some ministers talking about Howard Thurman and they describing his method of preaching and all that sort of thing, and he was just a myth to me then, and it was only many years later that I really encountered Thurman per se and heard him speak. I was a student at Colgate Rochester Divinity School, and that's when I first heard him speak, and that was at least 10 or 12 years after this, that, and we had him to come into one of our classes there, and we dialogued with him, and I was really overwhelmed by him. It was at that time that I was thinking about going into literature and theology after I finished my MA in religion. And finally, when I wound up in literature and theology, working on the PhD degree at Emory, I wanted to combine somehow the aspects of my study in, I had 2 degrees in English and literature, and I had 1 degree in religious studies, and I wanted to combine the 2 fields in some kind of way. And Thurman was just the best person for me to do that with. I mean, he just let me see clearly in the black experience where literature and theology really unfolds and how it can work so harmoniously together, and how I really was perfectly centered where I should be, really, in the area of literature theology. And so this really helps reaffirm me in where I am at this point and how I got there. And let me respond. I don't have that much response to what Professor Evans said and Professor Charles, but let me say this, that I know that Thurman means many things. I was really hesitant to publicize any of my thinking on Thurman because I only heard Thurman speak about 5 times, and I did a lot of research, and I did have a seminar under him for a week, like you did, Dr. Mitchell. That was a year before you did, and that, I learned a lot from that, and it was just before, it was while I was working on the dissertation, and he knew I was working on the dissertation, and that was one of the reasons Dr. Smith got me into the seminar there for that week, and it was really the thing that I needed, really did, because I heard him speak, but I'd never been on a journey with him for a whole week, and it really turned out well. And then I heard him speak a couple more times after that. And after the dissertation was finished, I sent the dissertation to him, and he read it, and he sent it back to me, and I received his commentary on it a day of my graduation. And so it was very positive, and he really loved that ashamed of being himself, very much so. And he said it was just, he said, I really captured the spirit and character of his whole thinking and all. And I was highly impressed by that. And I had looked forward to many more years of association with him, you know. But he was cut short. Really not short, but a really long life he lived. So I was saying, he means many things to many people, and I, like I said, I was reluctant to publicize anything on him because he was such a legend, and I was afraid I might offend the people who had known him so long, as you spoke of him, Dr. Evans, and your so long association with him, and so you know much more about him personally than I do. So I'm so glad that your response was as positive as it was. And that also was a problem for me, the problem you said about his escaping historical categories. That made it difficult to really deal with him in any kind of way. And but I think that literature and theology perspective really did fit very well. In terms of his the shaman and priest idea, which you raised, I thought he fell in between the priest and the shaman. He was not really a shaman. He did not declare himself as such. He simply, the shamanism enabled him, I really don't want to say it like that, but the whole thing of the shamanistic practice, whether he took it consciously or unconsciously, anyway, it enabled him to universalize the religious perspective so that it doesn't really come into any specific religious tradition, but this archaic figure belonged to the universal religious experience in no particular religious body could really claim it as their own and exclusively as their own. So that was his, that was the path which he tread, which was to toward the universal perspective. And I want to, and in terms of that healing point too, that you mentioned, where I got this notion from, mostly, I got a lot from reading Dr. Smith's dissertation on Thurman, and he brought that out so well in his book about the healing process. So that was a part of my, he didn't discuss the shamanistic aspect that it related to, but he certainly gave me a lot to go on in terms of Thurman's healing process. He gives a thorough analysis to that aspect of Thurman's ministry. And finally, in regard to the inner life, I was very impressed by your sermon. Okay, well, in regard to the statement you made about his teaching us that we did have, or do have, an inner life, that brought a lot to my mind. I'm not so sure that we're not aware as aware as we should be about our inner life, but I think it is that we are just afraid of our inner reason. We're afraid to delve deep into ourselves because, well, we're afraid of what we may find there. There is, of course, there is sickness there because of the treatment that we as a people have received in society, and we've had to suppress so much of our, feelings, because we couldn't, for fear of letting out our true feelings. And so there is a reluctance to go into our inner life, and we need healing there. And I think maybe that was his goal, not maybe necessarily to teach us that we do have an inner life, but to not to be afraid to face it. Well, he did use a lot of Carl Jung in the idea of the unconscious, allowing your unconscious to be to come out and to blend with the conscious mind, in order for the whole person to be manifested. So that would be my response to you on that point. Although I think you probably mean the same thing when you say that. You don't agree? Okay, well.
Your opinion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We were trying to keep ourselves to the hour, but we did start late, and given the paper and what Dr. Evans said about the paper, maybe there ought to be a few little questions or comments or something from the floor before we leave.
Yeah, I want to place in the record appreciation for the evening with Howard Thurman. I agree that we have neglected him for too long, but I think it would be unfortunate, since we're meeting in Washington, if someone didn't say a few words about Howard Thurman and Washington. How do you see Howard Thurman helping us to deal with structures of injustice and systems that oppress the poor? Does his use of myth help us in that way, or could we get some help with that, since we're so close to the White House?
Well,
Governor,
that's directly to you.
It is. Yeah. He didn't say so. Okay. I agree with a number of persons whom I have read in God and Human Freedom. I was really delighted by that book, God and Human Freedom. I can't call names right now, but two or three of the articles in Henry Young's book, God and Human Freedom, do really deal with that in a beautiful way. And also Dr. Smith deals with it very beautifully in Thurman as a prophet. And I agree with them wholeheartedly that Thurman was not an organization man, who he himself said he's not an organization man. He is not the type of person, he doesn't have the type of makeup to lead a movement such as that, that would achieve liberation goals. But he is a powerful instrument and undergirding force for people who lead such movements. He would have had a profound influence on Martin Luther King and other persons who were involved in the Black Liberation Movement. And he suggested ways of healing for Martin Luther King himself, when his resistances had been worn down, his nerves been worn down by his working out there in the field and leading movements and being under attack all the time. He needed some source of spiritual renewal, and certainly the person who is out there will burn up all of their spiritual energies and become fragmented in such a great way that they will need some form of healing. And certainly you've seen, I know I have seen numerous individuals involved in social change activities who were not whole people. And our movement has failed in many ways because our people burn out and become frustrated and turn away from the movement and sell out because they can't deal with the difficulties that are involved, the encounters that they have such a profound psychological effect on them that they can't hold out. And I experienced it numerously. In my experiences, I too was very much involved in the Black Liberation, Black Power movement associated with the liberation groups and the young militants. And I was on the faculty at Norfolk State College, and the police and the FBI came looking for me as a member of the faculty, and because I was out there in the streets leading marches and making speeches and working with the Black Liberation Army and all these guys walking around with their and they got to be robbing banks and saying they were liberating me.
The money.
That's right. And then so the FBI and all these came looking for me. And my president of the college, I got a terrible reputation. They called me the Angela Davis of Norfolk State College. And well, I came to realize that we were dealing with people who were not whole. And they just weren't ready. They couldn't stand this thing. They needed some kind of spiritual source of renewal and something to sustain them in such a rugged situation. And when I went to Colgate Rochester, I went because there were certain ministers who I had some kind of spiritual calling to deal situation, and I was encouraged by certain ministers who were also in SCLC and other places, and they told me that I could, through the church, be able to be much more effective in my work. And this I came to realize too, and I realized that some form of spiritual undergirding has to be done for, and I think he's the perfect person to lead us in that direction. He's that type of person, is the perfect person to help us maintain this kind of strength to hold out in a liberation. I think that's the failure of the liberation movement right now, is that we don't have that kind of spiritual power.
I've been an admirer of Howard Thurman ever since I came here to hear him in chapel in 1938. That's only 47 years ago. I'd like to think that I have all of his works that anybody has. I have a tremendous collection of Howard Thurman's writings and some writings about him. I think at this point that I will have to be a little bit critical, because we have said to ourselves that we've been too long getting to Howard Thurman in the Society for the Study of Black Religion, and I would say that that's probably just exactly the way Howard Thurman would want it. Luther, I think, knows whereof I speak when I say that I went to deal with Howard in a think tank sort of situation for 3 days, which was originally announced to deal with black religion and black theology, and Howard scrupulously avoided every single question. He would not deal with blackness in any sense, despite the fact as far as I was concerned, he was the original and perhaps the preeminent black theologian. His book, Jesus and the Disinherited, alone was enough of a theological contribution to give him the all-time championship or crown or whatever. But Howard was diametrically opposed to labels. He was into the sort of thing that Chuck has been talking about, where he intended not to be of any ethnic group, but rather to be a human being, so that we as black scholars are bringing him up at this point, partly because he would not at any point accept the notion of being a black scholar, a black mystic, or anything of the rest. And this was not because he wasn't confident. Back in 1947, a group of preachers in Oakland, California, when he had recently gone to the church in San Francisco, invited him to do our Lenten series. There weren't more than 15 or 20 of us at best. And he was to do a series of messages throughout Lent on Wednesdays or whenever it was. I don't remember exactly now. A masterful series, and a series which presented the very, very best of the black tradition. But I regret to have to report that that's the only time I ever saw him use that. And any time he was ever in any audience where there were whites, he went back into this universal, mystical, and that was it. The thing that he could have given to black folk, the gift that he could have had with the black masses, the impact he could have had on them, he never even dreamed, apparently, of doing, and saved his entire output for those few blacks who could at least go through the motions of understanding him, and left the black masses from which he had himself stated he rose for somebody else to pastor. Now, he pastored me. As Mozilla knows, when our son died, there was nobody more pastoral to me than Howard Thurman. He was on campus when our son died, and he ministered me in profound ways. But he would not minister to nitty-gritty blacks, and he would not identify with the tradition, and I think it's only honest enough to say
it. Well, wait just a minute. Let me... Now, you say he would not identify with the black tradition.
That's right. He would not exercise his gifts in black idiom. He would not use the imagery. He could have done a revival in anybody's church with the stuff he was doing for us in that time. I never saw him do it any other place before or since.
Did you want to respond to him? I was going to respond in a minute, but I was going to let him say what he was going to say.
I think that would be quite typical of black scholars of Howard's time. I mean, this consciousness of blackness was just a recent thing. You know, with scholars, black scholars. Particularly. I mean, if you read the sermon of Dr. King, you wouldn't think that he would be preaching to black people. At least that collection of sermons on love. His analogies, his examples, are not black examples at all.
But I would just like to add to that, it's not just typical of black scholars. I think it's sort of typical of certain kinds of movements of the late modern world. It's almost like saying Karl Marx did not write for the proletariat. It has something to do, I think, with the notion of calling. Now, if you have a notion that the calling is always very general, and general in the sense that whatever calling there is has to be generally for those people whom I think it ought to be for, then you can say that if you are this, then you ought to do that. But if you have a more specific notion of calling, which means that some people are called or have gifts for some kinds of things and some people don't,
I don't know how one can say, you may be absolutely right, Henry, but I don't know how anyone could say that that he could have done this with the black masses. He might have been able to do that with the black masses, but it also may be the case that he did what he could do with those whom he could do it with. And that might be a part of his modesty, a modesty of his own understanding and appreciation of what his gifts were. I would rather leave that in the bed.
Well, I want to disagree with that. I don't believe it. I'm sure he did. You can't say that he did not identify with the black masses, because I think the person that could best answer that is Dr. Smith.
I was hoping he'd speak up.
Who knows that he definitely was came out of his roots or in the blackest mission. He never lost his roots. I mean, he's never a man to turn away from his roots. He was always just like Charles said, he was his body, you know. He was always in his body. And we asked him the question when he was at Colgate Rochester, how should we feel about our, you know, color as black people? And it was, and should we be proud of blackness, of being black and all that? So he went into a very long, beautiful speech on how his soul was inculcated within his body, and that was him. He was who he was, and he could never turn loose his roots. And you took that out of mind. I was going to respond by saying that he responded to his calling, and his calling was as a black man to black people. And his religious experience began in a black church. His conversion took place there. He passed at the black church. He worked at the black schools, and he worked with black students. And he rose from one point in his life to another, to heights. He rose from the black experience to the universal experience. He didn't just jump into the universal experience all at once. But he proceeded through grades and levels of experience until he got to the height of universality. And from that point, he could address all experiences of all cultures and races and backgrounds and what have you. So I don't think that wasn't his calling, to simply speak and address the problems of black people.
I'll give you just 2 seconds. Right after he did this magnificent thing with nitty-gritty black preachers, we asked him to address the National Baptist Sunday School Congress, hoping that he would use the same communication skills, the same idiom he had used with us. 10,000 Baptists sitting up there waiting for him to do what he had done for us, because we wanted him desperately to do what he had done. When he got in front of 10,000 nitty-gritty black Baptists, he went back to his universal.
Maybe
well,
that's what they needed.
That's what I was going to say. You can't judge him by this one incident.
They didn't relate to it at all, and it wasn't his understanding. I'm telling you nitty-gritty details. We told him what we wanted, and he didn't do it.
Well, I didn't get up to talk. I came up to preside. Things getting heavy here. We'll take Gino next. Now, you don't need to adjust. This thing has gotten all out. So you don't need to just address it to Mazzella. She's got the one. I mean, this thing is all over now. So you can talk to each other or Mazzella. And he's sitting here. He's not saying anything. No, I can't make him talk. Gino, you go. And then somebody, Gayrod. Okay, Gino.
I'm
going
to make my comments as brief as I can. So I think words like that and roots are very key for my understanding. Especially in light of your presentation, what I heard Chelsea also, Brother Evans say. When Chuck said that Howard understood that blacks are modern people, I think we should understand that we are modern people in an old way. There's a sense in which my understanding of Howard raises questions of directionality. Many of the people in whom I guess have. feel very fortunate to have been able to spend two uninterrupted afternoons with him a couple of years before his death. And we talked about many things, and I'm sure anybody who's been one-on-one with him had the experience of starting out on one subject, going somewhere else. You never knew where you were going to wind up from minute to minute. You just sort of caught up in the flow. And there was a sense in which you aren't really conscious of the direction in which the flow is going until you can step out of it and look back on it. And I recall how during the course of those two afternoons, occasionally he would come to a statement like, and I should set this up, because he refused to fly an airplane, he decided to travel by train in the dead of winter from San Francisco to Durham. The train got delayed somewhere in Kansas in a big snowstorm, and he caught cold. So we were in his motel room with him in the bed, sitting up, and I'm sitting at his feet. And in the course of these conversations, he would stop and say, "I'm just trying to get back to my mother." And so help me, it seemed to me that whenever he started talking that way, there was a radiance about him. And he would talk about the sense of, I had images of clean sheets, the smell of a good breakfast early in the morning, all that's associated with a loving woman brings security, positive feeling, and so forth. I'm interested in the sense of directionality as a historian because as something of a religious historian, it seems to me that we too often think in terms of history as forward movement and how it was actually backward moving, not necessarily upward moving or downward moving, but backward moving, and in this sense of trying to come to grips with Stark's spirit through the instrument of his body was trying to make a reconnection with this sense of primordial birth and therein maintain the anchor, to keep the anchor in place, to maintain a sense of moorings. And when you really talk about roots, to stay rooted in far more than the sense of black folks. And this is why I think, in a sense, color wasn't the final analysis, only secondary to him. And why he would go back to this sense of universalness, because at the point one really came to grips with root, you weren't talking at that level. You're talking with a sense of connectedness to all the unity that is the world that can be perhaps symbolized by the concept of God. And so then, while many of us have been inclined to think in terms of progress moving backward, Howell has been trying to get us to see in terms of the inward journey this way. And unless we turn to look that way, and even to move in that direction, then we will finally miss out on it all, because once the anchor is taken up and you don't have the right propulsion, you just drift. And in all sense of identity, the very ground of identity and meaning is lost in terms of humanism.
Okay, Ron.
Something that doesn't settle the matter, but certainly throws a lot of light on it when she said that he was a man of many parts. So you didn't put it quite that way, but I think you said he was many things to many people. And I think the image of the shaman certainly helps us to understand this double-sided or triple-sided or many-sided aspect of his personality. Shaman can be in two places at the same time. You know, he can be in New York and in London at the same time without drugs. I remember during the movement days that Howard Thurman let us know in NCDC that he was with us. When we were in Oakland, California, he sent word that he was sorry he couldn't be there. When we had an executive committee meeting of NCDC in Chicago, and I think this was at the time of King's death, we met with Howard Thurman, the executive committee of NCDC met with him, and he talked to us so that he was friendly. He wanted to indicate that he was sort of with us, but he wasn't marching, and he wasn't
doing everything other people were doing. But I always had the feeling during those days that he was around, that he was kind of looking on what was going on and approving of the Black movement. Jefferson Rogers, who knew him as well, I guess, as anybody, told me that and Stokely Carmichael. Dr. Fairman got out his handkerchief and wiped his head and started walking up and down the floor. So I think to say he was a universal human being means that, you know, he was many things, man of many parts. He had integrated content into one great, tremendous person. But I think it's not correct to say that he had no interest.
Probably the only other person who's taken time out and studied and read and written on Thurman, and I don't think he ought to just get away without saying anything.
Amen.
So I'm just going to exercise the chair and tell him to just comment on whatever he thinks is